I'm Mboya Nicholson, and this is the Jazz Legacy Radio Podcast. It's a no-brainer that pathology and culture are not one and the same. But when dealing with the fragile sensibilities of those who mistake sociological statistics for a full description of being human where black folks are concerned, stating such a simple fact is heresy. And when black artists are the subject of discussion, Billie Holiday is often the figure painted as the perpetual downcast, downhearted, downtrodden, down diva. And so, the filmmakers, authors, journalists, and such wring their little hands and furrow their little brows, ready once again to mourn every inch of her life, refusing to suppose the wit she conveyed on recordings could mean anything. It's much easier to condescend in the guise of sympathy if you can paint someone as not only tragically alone, but innately hopeless. Perhaps pity-eye theatricality and the reverse egotism disguised in the patronizing performance of guilt is too much of a full-time job to worry about discerning whether one's sympathy is really condescension. And so every couple of years, pop culture's mad scientists haul out their dust-laden agenda to regurgitate tried and not-so-true moldy misconceptions to create the cardboard cutout version of Billie Holiday that does not require knowledge of her music, the multifaceted, multi-layered black experience, her musicality, or anything in-depth about jazz. Years ago, I heard a panel discussion on radio that started out by summing up Lady Day as a drug addict who died in 1959. I decided that if that was their only conclusion, more than likely they would have missed the boat on a lot of things. So I turned off the show and got more out of listening to her recordings than I ever would from hearing some folks babbling on whose knowledge of Billie Holiday probably starts and stops with her first and last name. These flying monkeys of media never seem to tire of the monochrome portrait of Lady Day consistently utilized by pop culture's machinery, which either makes her into a pity party or a non-human entity devoid of human traits like humor, happiness, those moments we all have of introspection, thoughtfulness, tenderness. She's either reinvented as a scared deer in the headlights or as some raging bull. Either way, these sapsucker-conceived interpretations of her originate in an idea that blacks are not just less than human, but that they are inherently ill-fated and in need of handler, keeper, pity, benevolent governing. But all those colonial tropes are draped in new societal disguises in the 21st century. And they were in disguise in the 20th as well. But those tropes and their raggedy inventors are not representative of the artistry of Lady Day, black culture, or its many facets. None of which, those with what I call pith helmet prerogative, those with safari explorer in search of the authentically black syndrome, would ever recognize or could ever conceive of. The truth isn't in the tropes. It's in the music. It's in the recordings Holiday made in her youth, the ones with Benny Goodman or Teddy Wilson, with that mix of an embrace and playful irreverence. That's what frustrates the melodrama practitioners, the sap seekers, the pith helmet armchair blackologists who mistakenly believe Billie Holiday's genius was in being a tragedy. So then, what about this voice? What about this sound that's taken for granted? And to be clear, I'm talking about the first phase of Billie on record, the Billie whose first recording, albeit a financial flop, was a declaration of a new voice, an optimistic spark of sound. I'm talking about the first time we heard Billie musically say, "I don't care if you dare me, I dare me." The first recording, My Mother's Son-in-Law, was financed by an enthusiastic John Hammond, whose love for jazz and support of its musicians was countered by his tendency to dictate to African-American performers how he felt their art ought to reflect their heritage. Like when he had dismissed Duke Ellington's Black, Brown, and Beige, writing a finger-wagging lecture to Ellington, claiming that he was abandoning his people's struggle. Hammond's remarks illustrate a variation on the same theme if we relate it to how Billie Holiday's narrative is often manipulated by outside opinions regarding what is an accepted story of the black experience, particularly of a specific generation of blacks. Holiday's debut, My Mother's Son-in-Law, was recorded in 1933, and recordings she did afterward demonstrate the playful, rhythmically vibrant sound that lends itself to something that writers and pop culture in general would rather dismiss. They prefer instead to romanticize the latter part of Holiday's career, since it's easier to plaster melodrama and a cliche on top of her addictive tendencies and the ubiquitous tragedies that have been misconstrued as defining her and her art. But Lady Day's musical dreams were no caricature and no cartoon. Little Eleanora Fagan's skyward aspirations were inspired by Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong. You could say the plaintive quality Bessie Smith could provoke out of her own voice was accentuated in a different way in Holiday's own vocal style. Smith had a bigger sound, playful, but in a larger way. Billie Holiday's sound was more like a soft-spoken, sure, confident person. Her voice was inherently thinner, but not thin in a disparaging way. The plaintive tone had a different curve to it, just because of the difference in her voice. Whereas Smith had an innate volume to her, like someone speaking directly in both tone and energy, Holiday's confidence was different. It was an intensity that was cooler, calmer. She was like someone whose eyes had volume. Meanwhile, from Louis Armstrong, maybe her most obvious influence, Lady Day got her sense of rhythm and her style of phrasing. Aspects of her development, like the impact of Armstrong and Smith, often went right over the heads of those who wrote as if they wanted to perpetuate cliches and stereotypes regarding Billie Holiday. There was a joy in her sound because there was a joy in those who influenced her. The sophisticated way of phrasing introduced to popular music by Louis Armstrong became an aspect of Holiday's own style and gave her that wry bit of musical wit. Carmen McRae remembered, "Nobody was doing that hip way of singing, except for Pops," which is what jazz musicians call Louis Armstrong, more so than Satchmo. Indeed, what Billie Holiday got from Pops is clearly evident in the duets they recorded together. You could even argue that there was more of an echo of Pops in Lady Day than perhaps Bessie Smith. But popular culture's droning din only parrots the sickly, soured over, ripened, lazily researched, brown-edged facts ad nauseum. And none of the regurgitated stories explain her genius. None of the distractions people write about to avoid actually writing about her as a musician are her genius. Her artistry is her genius. Her ability to make a beautiful sound with her own artistic judgment, musical reflexes, and knowledge of a song. The accepted narrative that has been cranked out for six decades ignores her artistry and her mastery, obsessing instead over aspects of her life that were her experience but don't explain why she is musically important. When Lady Day launched into telling us she wished on the moon, the lament was not just hers but everyone's. But it's as if the sound had a hat tipped to the side, just at the right angle, not enough to be an affectation, but just enough to be noticed, or more so, detected. And on another selection, there's a beam of light again, as she flirts with the rhythmic lyric, "Tennessee's sending me Emily Brown, Miss Brown to you." With Teddy Wilson and cohorts including Benny Goodman, the ensemble proves music equals fraternity, and that norms built around separation are abnormal. But Hollywood's depictions of Lady Day and her time seldom get reality right. The core of a sugar-coated industry is, of course, sugar. And the subtleties of everyday life are ineligible for Tinseltown's acceptance. Those subtleties, the in-betweens that any cliché ignores, contradict the facade. The age-old facade. The cotton plant as boutonniere in a breast pocket compromise of a suit jacket, reminding us that for all the lip service about our ancestors, heroes, heroines, successes, and leaders, deep down, those who run image factories, and some who were previously excluded but are now on the inside, are blissfully working towards an updated minstrel show, 21st century style. It's a lot more subtle these days. Billie Holiday, from the recollections of those who knew her, from the recounting of Carmen McRae, Mel Waldron, Annie Ross, just to name a few, is the antithesis of such discount bin so-called cultural authenticity. Abby Lincoln once said, "They'll steal your ancestors if you let them." There seems to be some agenda of stealing based on summing up Lady Day by the last few years of her life. But what is their angle? Miss Holiday is much more than the weather-beaten, dog-eared, bleary-eyed, teary-eyed pity-palooza. Perhaps they will hearken back only so far with Holiday because freezing her inside the four corners of the bleak years that subsequently led to her death fits the compartment of fantasizing black destruction. I need no such fantasy land, Billy, constructed by writers whose knowledge of Lady Day doesn't go beyond her drug habit, a white gardenia, or the song Strange Fruit, and a few first lines of God Bless the Child, if they even know those songs. And then there's the movie considered a classic, even though Lady Day is written to be a shivering, whimpering, frightened mass of nerves, afraid of her own shadow. When the movie was released, colleagues of Holiday's made their anger known. That movie, Lady Sings the Blues, was based in large part on Holiday's so-called memoir, primarily written by William Dufty, a journalist Holiday knew. It's widely full of fallacies. Annie Ross was blunt. "I hated the book," she stated. Carmen McRae said, "I remember when I read it, there was some stuff that I said, 'No, lady, 'cause I was there. And that's not, unless I was crazy and looking the other way or something." Nevertheless, the book and then the movie that it was based on 2 decades later were immovable representations of who people thought Billie Holiday was. And the movie in particular became the first impression of Holiday for many people coming of age or born after Watergate, despite many inaccuracies. Theatrical works about Billie are somewhat more accurate, but why the obsession with her destruction? She was a phenomenon. The impact of her voice, of her personality as a whole, on people, on popular music, is potentially richer. Of course, her downfall is part of her story, but it is not her story. How Lady Day sounded and what effect she had on people like Carmen McRae and Annie Ross, just to name a few, is much more interesting than the typical "I show is down and tired and sad," unimpressive, uninspired tropes. Candid outtakes of Holiday rehearsing songs in the comfortable company of her fellow musicians showcases the gentle, joking aspects of her personality, aspects of her that are overlooked in the typical melodramatic, cartoon-like depictions usually vomited up by Hollywood. Today, the cartoonery is not so overt, but the new millennium still has burnt cork tendencies, and many writers still accept that as authentic black depictions. So the real story is in the tug that Lady Day had on the public the first time she was heard. Carmen McRae stated that no one was phrasing like Billie when she came on the scene except for Louis Armstrong. And as mentioned before, Lady Day cited Pops as her big influence. And while she was undoubtedly Armstrong and undoubtedly Bessie Smith, she was unquestionably Billie. So, forgo the predictable coloring book renditions of Billie. Check out the recordings instead, those early ones from the 1930s in particular, that all those pith helmet wearers are afraid of, because those records fly in the face of any dressed-up elaborate cliches, and because Billie's voice and all those instrumentalists easily contradict all the indirect but obviously burnt cork-inspired agendas any ill-informed journalist or Hollywood writer might dream up. The real Lady Day is the truth. Accept no imitations.